This is Bob Hayes, a.k.a. Petty Officer Hayes, heavy on the petty, and you are listening to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is May 3rd, 2007. This is show number 76, and I'm your host, Jules Cizek. In today's show, I'll discuss the Jerez and Istanbul GP rounds. We'll have a chat with Liam Schubert about the Istanbul race and go through some related news items. But first, the big news from MotoGPOD is that Bob Hayes is back. Bob returned to the States in March, was debriefed, and returned home in early April. Welcome home back, Bob. Bob recorded a short hello for all the show's loyal fans, and without further ado, here it is.
Hey, all you MotoGPOD fans out there, this is Bob Hayes. I'm back from deployment in Iraq. I'm not quite ready to take the show over yet, so Jules is going to be doing another couple of episodes. I've got to get my life situated here, get the state-of-the-art MotoGPOD studios set back up and all of that sort of thing. But pretty soon we'll be back out there making new podcasts and getting some good interviews and all the stuff that you've come to learn to like and love. I do want to say a big thank you to all the people that sent emails and stuff like that when I was over there. It was really great. I hope I managed to respond to all of them. And also a big thank you to Jim Race and Jules Cizek for doing the show while I was gone and taking care of MotoGPOD and putting out some real quality episodes, especially the last few. So in the meantime, why don't we go ahead and listen to what Jules has got in store for us today. So take it away, Jules.
Thanks, Bob. I'm sure I speak for all your fans when I say we're glad to see you home and safe and sound. On March 25th, the second MotoGP race of the season took place at Jerez, Spain, quite possibly the most raucous venue of the year. Others have done a much better homage to just how crazy it is, so I won't get too much into it here, especially since I've never been there. But the show notes at MotoGPOD.com include links to the MotoLiam blog and the Kropotkin Thinks blog, where the madness of Jerez is captured beautifully in words and pictures. The race itself was looking quite interesting, with preseason title favorites Danny Pedrosa and Valentino Rossi first and second on the grid, separated by a mere 0.05 of a second. Qatar's winner, Stoner, was on second row in fifth, but last year's Jerez winner, Loris Caparossi, was a dismal 15th. Dismal, that is, until you look at the times covering the first through 15th position. Danny and Paul and Loris Caparossi in 15th were just 0.989 seconds apart. The big surprise in the front row was Spaniard Carlos Checa, in third and within 0.58 of Paul in just his second race on the LCR Honda. Carlos has really been impressive the last few years. The race itself played itself out along a familiar script. Valentino Rossi slotted in behind Danny Pedrosa after a good start, passed Danny halfway around the first lap, and never relinquished his lead for the rest of the race. Danny never threatened Rossi, try as he might, but was also safe from any advances from third-placed Edwards, who in turn had left the next group behind as well. So the podium was pretty much decided by halfway through the first lap, but the battle behind the trio was heating up nicely. Hayden and Hopper had a great little fight, which John eventually won. Unfortunately, the minor victory was short-lived. Chased by Tony Elias, probably the most damn the torpedoes full steam ahead rider in the sport today, Hopkins rode his heart out and paid the price. Whether or not it was the pace or the pressure is not really relevant, but regardless, Hopper made a mistake, tucked into the front end, and crashed on lap 16. He did remount and finished last, but barely 2 seconds behind Olivier Jacques on a Kawasaki who had not crashed. So, still pretty good for Hopper. And if you remember, Hopper gave Danny quite a fight in Qatar, and he is proving to be a force to be reckoned with from race to race this season. Kudos to Suzuki for a wonderful 800cc package, and kudos to Hopper for some brass balls riding. Nikki Hayden slid from 4th to 7th between laps 15 and 22 and was visibly disappointed at the end, knowing there's still lots of work to do, both learning the 800 and learning its setup characteristics. The final standings then were Rossi, Pedrosa, Edwards on the podium. 1.5 seconds behind Edwards was Elias and Stoner. 5 seconds behind Stoner, Carlos Checa. A further 4 to Hayden. Marco Melandri, 5 seconds behind Hayden. Melandri followed by Vermeulen and Nakano. Last year's winner, Caparossi, finished 12th behind his satellite team's rider, Barros. Randy Dipugne beat Makoto Tamada by a massive 10 seconds in 13th. Sylvain Guintoli was 14th. Kenny Jr. on the Team KR bike finished 12 seconds from 14th but managed to pick up a point. Out of the points were wildcard Suzuki rider Kosuke Akiyoshi, Kawasaki's Olivier Jacques, and just 2.5 seconds behind Hopkins, who, as you remember, fell 11 laps from the end. And the only rider who did not finish the race was Alex Hoffman. And he didn't crash. He came into the pits after the first lap for a mechanical, and due to a communication error, hopped on his number 2 bike and rode out. He was black flagged and forced to retire, as you can only switch bikes during a wet race. This was a kind of a blow to Dantin. We came close to having the entire grid finish the race, which I believe would be a first. Maybe it'll happen later this year. After the Jerez race, the championship standings became Rossi with 45 points, Stoner with 36, Pedrosa with 36, but Stoner ahead due to his Qatar win, Edwards with 26, Melandri with 19, followed by Hayden, Vermeulen, Elias, Hopkins, and Barros. Now you fast forward to April 22nd and the Grand Prix of Turkey. After the dust settled in qualifying, Rossi was in pole, his teammate Colin Edwards next to him, and on the other side of the first row, Danny Pedrosa. Rossi has been on the front row in all three races so far, but he knew that only a hole shot would give him a chance to beat Stoner. Behind him, Olivier Jacques came into the next left-hander way too hot, was clipped slightly in the rear by Pedrosa, clipped the rear of Colin Edwards' bike, and when Danny Pedrosa went down, Christopher Mullen Suzuki climbed in onto the back of Pedrosa's Honda, and all four riders were sent flying and sliding into the gravel. Vermeulen's bike rode on top of Pedrosa's, and Chris quickly ran over when everything was kind of halted and picked up the machine, restarted, and there's a story there as well, but let's get to that later. He got on the bike and rode off. Every time there's this kind of an incident, the various motorcycle forums and mailing lists light up with all sorts of interesting and sometimes ridiculous commentary. The most common thread I've seen, other than Olivier Jacques simply getting in too hot, is that Danny Pedrosa somehow caused the crash but not yielding to OJ's line. To me, this is pretty preposterous. Although I can understand why someone would see this when watching the side view of the broadcast. But looking from above, from the helicopter view, it's clear that OJ was already out of control before he even passed Pedrosa. Danny had absolutely no way of knowing OJ was coming, and did in fact try to pick up his bike in mid-corner to avoid the Kawasaki attack, but was nevertheless taken down. Edwards and Vermeulen were obviously totally innocent victims, Edwards especially so. If you want to see something really painful looking, find the onboard shot of Edwards the moment he gets hit by OJ. One moment he's hanging off in mid-corner, next thing he's just gone. But I really think that this wasn't just OJ getting in too hot into the corner. Rossi's remerge definitely had an effect on the incident, probably causing several riders to alter their pace slightly, possibly confusing other riders and wrecking their concentration. But you really have to watch the overhead view again to see the other part of the incident, which I haven't heard anybody else mention. I actually just noticed it recently as I was reviewing my notes for this show. What you see is Elias doing a tremendous wiggle just past the corner's apex, and he looks very close to losing it. He ends up in the center of the track and totally causes Rossi and Hayden to run further wide and slow down, which quite possibly causes Edwards and Pedrosa to slow down. And now if Edwards and Pedrosa slow down, this is probably why OJ looked so hot coming in and why they were riding such varied lines. Now, OJ was riding too hot through the corner, don't get me wrong, but the incident wasn't quite as simple as one rider's error. It was more of a butterfly effect. It's worth noting, by the way, that this was only Colin Edwards' second non-point finish since he joined the Yamaha GP team in 2005. The other being his crash in the wet race at Phillip Island in 2006. Pretty amazing stuff, Colin. That's got to be some kind of a record. Meanwhile, the race went on, and although Casey Stoner ran away with the win, there was a lot of excitement behind him. Actually, just seeing the way he won this race was tremendously exciting. He's quite something to watch when the TV cameras are actually on him. The next big moment of the contest came on lap 9. Rossi and Elias managed to pass Caparex. Elias decided to get past the doctor, and the two almost touched, Rossi having to stand up the bike to avoid a collision. Now, this incident has turned into a most unusual post-race war of words. Rossi accused Elias of being too wild and dangerous and not riding a racing line. Elias shrugged it off as a racing incident. Echoes of Rossi's last corner clash with Gibernau in Jerez 2005, kind of. And if there's such a thing as karma, Rossi has definitely had his fill in the last 18 months. Now, the Italian media has gotten kind of ridiculous with this story, to the point where I just don't know what has really been said and what's just conjecture and sensationalism. The bottom line, however, is that Rossi was a bit fumed. I don't think he's blaming Elias for what happened to his tires, but he definitely feels he was wronged. And I've heard all sorts of talk about inside line having right of way, but Elias riding like a bully, you know, it's an emotional topic, obviously. Let's face it, we love Elias's style. He somehow managed to make this signature sliding style of the 990 era work on a traction-controlled 800cc GP bike. But because of this, his racing line is dramatically different than someone riding a smooth 250cc style line. And when these two lines cross in a passing situation, you will always have a moment like the one Rossi and Elias experienced. And what can be done about it? Should Elias be told how to ride, not be allowed to experiment with a radically different style that allows him to achieve incredible results? Should he be expected to behave during a pass? If so, how is he supposed to make his passes? Ride two different styles? On the other hand, what can the opponent do? Get out of the way, thus losing speed, and let Tony have his way, not giving in and possibly causing a collision? It's kind of comical to note that Casey Stoner also said Tony was too dangerous and that he should grow up. Casey also had a similar run with Tony during practice the previous Friday. But you have to admit, it's funny for the little kid from Australia who was the terror of the track last year having this to say. I even remember Nick Harris saying, "Ooh, he's hesitating passing Stoner, and I don't blame him." Anyway, I'm honestly on the fence with the Rossi-Elias thing. I think Rossi has lost his cool, but that doesn't make him wrong. Or maybe it does. So if you guys could email me your thoughts on it, please send it mail to MotoGPOD@MotoGPOD.com. Thanks. Anyhow, the short story is Elias passed Rossi. Clean or not, he passed him. And then he said bye-bye and left the field behind, taking a very, very solid second place. The Istanbul race was, by the way, one of the first races in several years that I was unable to watch live. MotoGP.com's live video feed failed just before the start of the race. I think it's pretty much affected everybody in the U.S. It worked great for the 125 and 250 races, both of which were fabulous, and if you have the time, you should definitely watch them. Anyway, I decided to keep trying, and I used the website's timing screens instead. So I didn't know what happened in the crash. I just knew that OJ, Edwards, Pedrosa, and Vermeulen were down. And then Vermeulen was up. One of the benefits of watching the timing screen is that I was able to see interesting things that the broadcast never showed. One of these was Chris Vermeulen's lap times, starting with lap 3. Chris started turning out incredible laps. High 154s, low 155s, slowly dropping into the very low 154s. Most people know that he set the race's fastest lap, 1 minute 54.026 seconds. But what they may not realize is that for the second half of the race, CV was consistently faster than Casey Stoner. Only he started the race effectively 22 seconds behind. Nevertheless, his incredible pace allowed him to catch Kenny Jr., who was terribly off pace, running mid-157s for most of the race. And by lap 16, Chris caught up and passed Gintoli, Tamara, and Nakano. And on lap 20, he got Carlos Checa as well. He finished just over 7 seconds behind Rossi in 10th. But his pace was over 2.5 seconds faster than Rossi per lap. So 3 more laps and he'd have had a top 10 finish after falling. Pretty amazing. His pace on Monday during the post-race test only confirmed just how well he rode at this track. And what a shame it was that he had to run with a 22-second handicap. And, as it turned out, bent clip-ons to boot. Oh yeah, and I did say Rossi in 10th. On lap 14, just as Vermeulen caught a big pack of riders in the back, Rossi inexplicably began falling through the ranks. It was obviously a tire or mechanical problem, with the former turning out to be true. On lap 15, he was down in 6th. On lap 16, in 8th, having been passed by charging Alex Barros and Nicky Hayden. 9th, on lap 20, having been passed by Randy Depugne, and finally falling to 10th when Alex Hoffman passed him. The final exciting story from Istanbul GP was the 4th place finish from Pramac Dantin Ducati's Alex Barros. Alex had a great start, surging from 13th on the grid to 8th, where he stayed for more than half the race. On lap 13, however, Barros began his charge. He took Hayden, got another spot from Rossi, benefited from Hopper running wide on lap 18, and taking 5th behind Melandri, and then pulling a beautiful pass on Marco to sit in 4th on lap 20. On the final lap, we saw probably the most frantic and thankfully 100% clean dogfight as Caparex attempted to hold up the Brazilian. On the final corner, Barros had a better drive out of the corner, but there was just not enough track left. Capirossi finished just 33 one-thousandths of a second ahead of Barros. A few more feet, and Alex Barros would have been back on the podium. One of the most interesting data points from the final results at Turkey were regarding tires. 8 out of the 9 finishers were on Bridgestones, including a Bridgestone podium, a full Bridgestone podium. David Emmett of Kropotkin Thinks has a very good write-up on why he thinks this happened, and you can read it on his blog at MotoGPMatters.com. I'll post a link in the show notes. So Stoner won, Elias got second, and Caparex rounded out the podium. Stoner took over the lead of the championship with 61 points, Rossi dropped to second with 51, Pedrosa remained in third with 36, but because of his 20-point gain on Pedrosa, Tony Elias is now just a point behind Danny with 35. Last Wednesday, I caught up with Liam Schubert of the Pramac Dantin MotoGP team, and we got to talk about Istanbul, Ducati, Bridgestoner, and lots of other good stuff. Always a pleasure to chat with Monsignor Schubert, so here we go.
Hey everybody, welcome back to MotoGPOD. This is Liam Schubert, known as Moto Liam Online, and we just wrapped up at the Istanbul Turkish Grand Prix a few days ago. It's Wednesday in the evening, and I'm back in Barcelona. Hi,
hey,
Jules.
What's up, Liam? Congratulations to your team. You guys had an amazing weekend. This is the best finish for Pramac by a long shot, right?
Actually, this is the second best finish that I can recall in the MotoGP era. There was a surprise podium in Qatar by Ruben Chaus towards the end of 2004.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're right.
So they have made the podium before, and they have won races back in the two-stroke era, which, you know, coincidentally, we have the same mechanics working for us now. The number one mechanic for Barros and the number one mechanic for Hoffman were on the old two-stroke squad.
Nice.
So we do have experience in knowing what it takes to prepare bikes. It's just a question of materials and talent of the rider.
Well, let's amend that to since you've been there.
It was a fantastic weekend for both our riders, for the Ducati factory and for Bridgestone in particular. Just amazing. For me, it's my highest finish in MotoGP to come in fourth and to be so close to coming in third with Alex Barros. We missed the podium by 0.33 seconds, which makes me think we should have drafted just a tiny bit around the corner. as we were coming out.
Because you guys were actually, I mean, Barros was actually catching Capirossi. It wasn't like, it wasn't the other way around. It wasn't like Capirossi caught him and passed him, right? It was,
well,
Barros came on strong and almost beat him.
Yeah, Barros had a great last lap, and Capirossi had a front end wobble.
Yep.
And lost some time, so Barros made the pass before the last corner. And Capirossi was just later on the brakes, dove right in there, and we couldn't get around him. We couldn't go even through the corner. So as we came out of the corner slingshot, we had a little bit better drive, but Capirossi was in front. And for us to make up, you know, more than a bike length in that short stretch before the finish line, you know, on all things being equal, fairly similar bikes, we got dang close, 0.033. And it's funny, I was hanging out later that night in the press room, and I was talking with Toby Moody and Julian Ryder about the race afterwards. We were discussing a couple of things, and Toby said, you know, wow, just you're fourth, that's fantastic. You guys must be, you know, elated. And I said, yeah, 0.033 seconds. And he's like, what, you're not happy with a fourth? And, you know, and in my head, it's like, man, I am here to win races. That's what all of us are here for. So whether you got to pay your dues and slog it out, or you're stuck in a bad situation like maybe Tech 3, we're still here because we love racing. And naturally, there's a huge desire and a huge enthusiasm to go for it and just be at the top. So, wow, I'm still kind of in shock. I just got a chill just now thinking about it, remembering what it was that afternoon. It was, I mean, you'll hear people say it was edge of the seat type racing between second and eighth place during that race. And in our garage, nobody sat down. Nobody's eyes left any of the monitors. You know, and then we'd flip channels just to see different data on one of the screens, but the race was always playing live on another one. And to be perfectly honest, we didn't know what was going on in the last corner, because we saw Barros make the pass after Capirossi wobbled, and then the entire paddock, the garage, we unloaded and sprinted across pit lane so we could jump up on the wall and climb the fence and cheer our rider on as he passed the line. So depending on how fast you sprinted, I got there in time to watch both bikes blaze by, and I didn't know who had secured the position until I went back in the box and saw the TV. But it was a wild Ducati right next to us on pit lane, and they're always next to us when we're at a race. And that's why we have a really good relationship, or I do, with some of those guys. They were going ballistic. Federico Mannoli was there. Livio was going crazy. And as soon as the race finished, within 30 seconds to a minute, everybody's cell phone on the team started blowing up. Congratulations and warm wishes coming in, and you know, people trying to call. Phones were being passed around, and we noticed the MotoGP, one of the cameramen, come into our box while we were busy cheering, and we saw ourselves on TV. We were like, yeah! I mean,
yeah,
the whole garage was ecstatic.
You were giving the barf salute, I noticed.
Something like that. I don't even remember. It was just wild. I mean,
or maybe just like
the elation was so high for a, you know, ostensibly we're a small privateer team that works for a small factory with a small factory, and you know, for the little guys to be up front and in such a fashion, three of the top four, and for us to finally have, you know, such a killer result. It's been years that we've been waiting for something like this, and not waiting. That's the wrong word. We're not waiting for a good result. We are always pushing ourselves for a good result. And for it to happen, just it blew our minds. You know, we looked at each other, me and Tomas, one of the guys on the team, and we said, you know, if you told us last year in Valencia that next year in the third race we'd have a fourth place position, we would have said, what, did 15 guys crash? No. No, we mentioned that. Wow, you could not believe that within just a couple races of the 07 season I would be up there challenging for podium. And granted, it is only one race, and there's only been three this year, so there's going to be changes as the season continues. But we were over the moon, and you know, I don't think I've ever seen so many hugs after a race by the team that didn't make the podium. It was phenomenal. You know, it was such a rush of emotion. I teared up afterwards and went to the back of the box to kind of just clear my head and give thanks and answer a couple of messages and it was so intense.
Yeah, it's so cool, dude. It's great to hear you hear how happy you guys were, and to see you guys cheering was great to see. And actually, everybody like kind of dropped their guard, dropped their like persona, like Livio Supi. He was like he's like Mr. You know, stone face usually, and to see him like actually laughing out loud was awesome.
This is something that it's peculiar in this world that when we watch the screen during a race or a practice, nobody's screwing around. Nobody jumps up and cheers. Nobody makes loud noises because, you know, this is MotoGP. This is such an intense focus, and there's so much riding on this. People don't, or the viewers at home might not realize this, but we sacrifice an incredible amount to be there and do this. You know, this is everything for us. And, like, we're watching the screen, and nobody wants a distraction or someone else jumping up and down. My chief mechanic, Lele, mentioned that we had a guy that was near the pit box, you know, the right on pit wall, that right at the track watching the screens. And every time Barros made a position, you know, he was jumping up and down and yelling. And both mechanics, the one for Barros and the one for Hoffman, turned around and looked at him and were like, dude's crazy. You know, we're professionals. We race week in and week out. But yes, as soon as the race was over, everything changed. Normally, as soon as the race is over, you know, we bring our tables into the box and we're stripping the bikes already. This time, everybody just unleashed and let all that emotion out. You know, it had been building up for so long hugging and crying and just, it was like a win for us. You know,
definitely.
It was like a win. And I say that because it's like a win for now. And in my mind.
Well, next time you're going to have to do a little bit better
than
that.
This gives us the momentum to push that much harder. And there was a lot of drama this weekend, you know, that came from a variety of places. I mean, obviously, Michelin didn't seem to be working at their normal level. Bridgestone really did their homework. And it's a forecasting deal also, because the higher corner speeds really are hard on the tires because they keep the temperature up. And, you know, no one had any data. And plus, this track only having been raced at twice, there wasn't a lot of data to begin with to study. So I think Bridgestone really knew what they were doing when they said, okay, we need to make tires for Turkey, and we've got to estimate how different things are going to be with an 800 compared to a 990. And they hit the nail on the head. I mean, that was a home run, a grand slam, to have 9 out of the top 11 be on Bridgestones. And you have never seen anything like that before at a MotoGP race. That's really one of the biggest stories of the weekend. Our garage was really extra stressed, I think, because we had a pretty good high side by Alex Hoffman in the warm-up, and he had bruised his ribs and maybe torn something in between the ribs, so he wasn't up to snuff, and it was a mad dash to get the bike prepped and ready to race. You know, we turned the warm-up bike into our spare bike, and he went out on the number two bike, and Barros was ill. I was kind of shocked when I was having lunch. I managed to get a few minutes for lunch while we were repairing the bike, Alex Hoffman's bike. And Barros was just kind of sitting there in our little office room looking really wiped out. And I knew he'd been sick all weekend because, you know, I hadn't seen too much of him and his usual energy wasn't there. And I noticed he had a bandage on his arm. And I said, what's up? You all right? And he said, you know, he went to Costa to get a shot because he was feeling so ill. So, you know, he took the bandage off and threw it away while I was eating lunch, and I was like, ooh, you know, my personal feelings at that point at lunchtime were, my God, we got to get the bike ready for Hoffman, and two, boy, Alex doesn't look so good. Barros, that is. So we had I think, you know, we weren't at 100% for the race, but our boys really put in some good lap times and fought their way up from bad qualifying positions.
And Alex had a top 10 finish too, so that was great. I mean, Hoffman.
Yeah, his lap times were great, and I spoke to him after the race, and he was just exhausted. He said he was all over the place. His lines were inconsistent, and he couldn't manhandle the bike because his ribs were messed up.
Oh, yeah,
He also banged some of the sensitive bits earlier, so he was pretty tender. And he said that, man, when I had to get around Rossi, he said, man, that guy is a racer. He was watching Rossi's brake hand the whole time when they were dicing. And he said Rossi would get off the brakes early, even though his tires were completely, you know, messed up. And Hoff got around him and he said, man, that was rough. Rossi tried everything to stay in front of Hoffman, as I'm sure he did, you know, to Depounier and anybody else that tried to pass him. So I think it was a little tricky for Hoffman being injured to get past Rossi, who was also kind of all over the place at that point because his tires were bad and, you know, there was less predictability in where you want to set up and cut somebody out. But Hoffman really put in some solid, solid lap times. And, you know, for sure, especially with the speed of the bikes and how good the Bridgestones were running, had he qualified a few positions higher up the grid, you know, he would have been dicing in that mix between, you know, third and eighth with everyone else. And I think that could have really been a really nice factor to have two of our boys so close and kind of pulling each other.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch the race live because MotoGP crapped out on me. MotoGP.com crapped out on me. So I was watching the timing screens. And so I actually got to see stuff that they weren't showing. So I saw him doing well. And then I saw Vermeulen, you know, just eating up the track from the very the moment he got that bike off.
Vermeulen was on fire.
He was crazy, dude. He like had nothing to lose or whatever, but he was unbelievable.
Or maybe just angry.
Maybe angry.
Whatever
the whatever.
Case, I've always.
Whatever it is,
always
it worked.
Really like this style, and I've always said that Vermeulen's going to do really well when everything clicks. And you know, unfortunately, Jacques pulled another, an oops. C'est la vie, and you know, Vermeulen got taken out of the mix, but that would have been a heck of a battle had he been up there. And you know, it just confirms how good he really is as a dark horse. The same way he ran off with the USGP last year and pulled 2 seconds plus on everybody. The kid's got it, got what it takes, and when things are working, you know, he's the one to watch out for. You know, surprisingly, another bike that seems to have really stepped up over the weekend is the Kawasaki, posting such really good top speeds in the last two events. And I don't know what their how slippery their bike is. I know it's very narrow. But as far as them posting top speeds, that tells me they've got something really good under the hood. So they might be another one to watch out for if Depounier puts it together,
which is totally a turnaround from their preseason, because their preseason they were just not, they didn't look very strong, like engine wise.
Well, yeah, as far as reliability, but you have to remember that it's a pang in one of the early preseason tests. They put in some blistering laps, and Depounier was within the top five a couple of times. So they've been doing something, and I'm sure it's going to pay off down the line. You know. It seemed like Suzuki and Kawasaki in particular didn't have the best 990 era, but they used all that data and they funneled it into the 800s. You know, we're going to fix everything we didn't have a chance to do before.
It's a very good play, you know, kind of giving up the season, one season to catch up to the factories.
It's an incredibly hard thing to explain to a sponsor, though, or, you know, to your factory people, if you say, we're going to drop 20 million or whatever on this season, knowing that we're hedging our bet that we're going to come up with something competitive next year, and we hope that no one else comes up with something better, because the factories don't know what each other one is doing. And you know, it is big money. People don't realize that, you know everyone says there's a dearth of sponsors and the money's not really flowing into GP the way it should be, and that's absolutely right. you know, a lot of smaller teams kind of just string it together. And I don't know how they managed to make it work, but I wonder about it, and I go, man. The only thing I can say is that the Europeans are so passionate, they put everything they got into racing. And of the factories, I don't think anybody exemplifies that more than Ducati and Ducati Corse's almost fanatical work ethic towards developing their ideas, because they have gone against the grain quite a bit with their designs. And man, they seem to have the right combination of Bridgestoner.
Bridgestoner. Supo said something like, this really proves we know how to make bikes. And race bikes, that's a really good point. It's like, you know, it is a small factory, but they really have a... And Corse, like you've told me before, is a very separate kind of entity, right? It's funded by Ducati, the main Ducati factory, but it's not... But
it really relies heavily on Shell and Marlboro. If either one of those sponsors were to take off, I think the racing activities would have to stop.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, it's really significant. And that's why whenever I see something in the press, we'd like to thank our technical sponsor, Shell, or whomever. You know, that really comes from deep down, and they mean it. And other times you see other people, I want to thank the sponsors, blah, blah, blah. And I just kind of brush it off because, you know, I know the level that those guys work at and the materials that they're working with. And you know, there's a reason why they're building CNC frames out of aluminum. They got a steel. It works. And it's, you know, it's the DNA of their racing philosophy to use a trellis frame. I sure wish you guys. I wish you guys could see some more details of the bike, like I do, because it's just so beautiful, and it's really a pleasure to be around these machines and to know where they come from and to hear the history from various people or engineers. Oh yeah, we tried this or we did that, and man, every time I see red, either my bike, particularly my bikes. Or the factory bikes. It's really nice. And yeah, I think our two teams have a slightly different bond than, well, I know we have a different bond than other factories and their satellite teams, because, you know, we're both scrambling to get out there and race, and we both deal with the same stuff, and you know, we support one another. If they need, you know, some kind of assistance that we can provide, we gladly give it to them. And it, you know, it goes both ways. If I really get in a pinch, then they really come to bat for me, because they want us to be successful too. And Minoli, the president of Ducati, was there. We were speaking after the race, and he was really proud of us for putting Barros up there. And my God, I wish we had beaten him, but nonetheless.
A 1-2-3 would have been cool too, but that,
how
that
cool is
Elias
that
guy would have been, you know, in the way.
Yeah, you know,
because I think what's really I've always liked this about Ducati is that they have a philosophy that is true to their road bikes and their race bikes. You know, they take that like mom and pop thing pretty far. They really seem like a family. Like, people who own Ducatis really hang together. You know what I mean? And it seems the same thing happens on the race teams. You know, they just hang together.
Yeah, they didn't show it on TV, but that after race celebration that was going on, before the factory team ran over to the podium, my whole team was in their garage congratulating those guys, and they were congratulating us and coming in through our garage, and all the engineers were hugging and you know, picking each other up and you know, it's a real vindication, the only way to put it is the emotion that we experience in an event like that, following a race where we've worked for months, you know, and years, some people for years, to do something like that. The emotion is the reward, and you cannot put a price on the emotion. You can't describe accurately the value that something like that has. Maybe a correlation could be, well, a woman dates a man and they have a beautiful relationship and there's obviously a love and they're together for years and then they get married. And that day is forever in her mind as the happiest day in her life because of that intensity of emotion that occurs at that moment. And when you, in racing, maybe when you win, it's the same kind of thing, especially if, you know, you're not winning all the time. It was brilliant. And
well, that's why we love racing, man. It's like, you know, that emotion transfers pretty far into the fan base too.
And looking towards Shanghai, I can say that I would absolutely love to see a Ducati 123 in Shanghai. A 1234 actually is one of the factory guys sent me a message saying that he wants to see 1234. But if we do a 1234, then the factory would not be too happy if one of their guys is off the podium. Yeah, I think China's really going to be a big test because Michelin rarely makes the same mistake twice, if ever. I don't know. And they've got a lot of overly intelligent people, you know, because you have to remember that this year the Formula One is not happening for them. So all those extra guys, they can flip a switch on the wall and all of a sudden all the engineers turn on, click, and you know everybody in France is working on China right now. It's 8:30 at night. They're working on China right now. So it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out because they had their problem last year with Valentino Rossi's front tire from overriding it. And it's a really long track with two enormous straightaways, so that'll play in our favor. And then people are thinking, oh, the slower sections are going to play towards the other bike's extra agility, which is also going to be an advantage for those bikes. But it's really, really hard on tires because, one, you've got a carcass that's got to deal with the acceleration and the high speed and the length of time it's at that speed because the straights are so long. And then you've got that really peculiar section after the first straight. You know, it kind of goes up to the right, and then there's a left on the right, and it's just like, and I think that's going to, because our bikes are faster through the corners, that's really going to add some extra stress, and I think that section is probably where we're going to see some mistakes. People are going to be blazing down the straight. They got to really get on the brakes late because that's, you know, that's the evolution of these bikes. Get on the brakes as late as possible and then rail that corner, which is a slow corner, and we're going to see a lot of front-end mishaps, I think.
Interesting call. I mean, do you think who do you think is going to be the main competition in terms of just pure bike, just taking the riders aside?
Well, it really depends on the weather. And the track is so big that you can have different weather conditions on different parts of the circuit. So tire choice is going to be critical.
Wow, that's interesting, huh?
Tire choice is going to be extremely critical. And, you know, if they give you a choice of a couple of tires and hopefully you picked right on Thursday, it'll match up perfectly for Sunday afternoon. I'm not predicting anybody, actually, because I think every manufacturer and every group of guys out there has the potential to get up there. It depends on who's feeling good. You know, internal self-confidence is so critical. I think Tony finally figured it out with the Estoril breakthrough. He's the only guy riding that particular way on the Honda teams. And, you know, granted, he's on different tires, so it's quite possible that he has found a loophole in the Bridgestone design that lets him ride that way, the same way that McCoy was able to find a loophole in his Michelin that allowed him to ride that way and no one else with those tires or, well, with that setup could ride it.
That's exactly the comparison I wanted to make earlier. Is that, like, I wanted to get your thoughts on the whole Elias thing, and I was exactly thinking the same thing. Like McCoy, kind of turned upside down the whole religion of how you ride a motorcycle around the track to go fast, And Elias is doing it on the 800s, totally. He's stepping it out. Him and Rossi, the reason why they collided was not because he was being aggressive, I think, was because his line is so different.
Yeah, and I should point out that the guys that seem to make the breakthroughs lately in motorcycle riding, well, since the McCloy breakthrough, they're all different as far as their body style. You've got what you'd consider your average rider, about 140 to 160 pounds, generally 5'8 or less. Rossi's an exception because he's so tall. But McCloy was tiny.
Yeah.
Really small. Able to use softer tires than anybody else. And then he would spin them up, but they were very sticky. So, you know, he was able to play a fine line, a balance point through his corners that no one else was able to do. Until they learned to start spinning the rear coming into corners and coming out. And that at that point, Michelin went to a harder compound because no one else could ride the soft tires that he could. And when they went to the harder stuff, he wasn't able to use it the same way. And I think it kind of forced him into some lesser results than what he was capable of. I think I think if he'd had exactly what he needed, he would have been fine. But granted, his style was a little ragged, especially, you know, in the two strokes, it's peaky. And then the early four strokes didn't have the same level of electronics. So they were also quite crazy to ride. Anyway, I hope he does fine whatever he decides to do. And then we see Pedrosa, who also has a radically different setup and tire choice than everyone else because he's so small. And who else is, you know, very, very small? Tony Eddie. I've had long conversations with him in English, and he's quite good at pointing out what he likes and what he doesn't like and what's working for him and what's not. And when we talked in the preseason, I was pretty worried that he wasn't going to be able to show the same level that he did in Estoril. And, you know, he struggled through the preseason, but they found something that worked. And, man, the kid was on fire in Turkey.
He was amazing. He started from the fourth row, too. I mean, it's just crazy how well he rode.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a good start, but it's not like he was up front all of a sudden. He was, you know, fifth, sixth spot, and then made his way
up. Well, look at how many passes. No, I don't think, unless you watch the timesheets, you don't see how many passes actually happened in that race. But I think it was over 50 passes in this race. That was beautiful, actually, to watch how everybody checked up everybody else and you know, kind of had to just stick a wheel in there. And I think a lot of people have been worried that the 800s, everyone's going to be just doing a train and trying to slingshot past each other on a straightaway or coming out of a corner. But once again, we're seeing a lot of passes coming in at the beginning and the middle section of the corner when neither rider wants to give up an inch.
Yeah, yeah. There were a couple of these four breast moments to that. It was just very surprising to see.
Well, we saw four breast last year, too, which was kind of neat.
Yeah, I'm just saying surprising for
800. China's really wide, so we're going to see some more of that, too. I can't wait. The problem is, there's not enough time before Shanghai. And what a lot of people don't realize is Italy was closed today for business. It's a national holiday in Italy. Something to do with celebrating the Americans in World War One or Two. I don't know. Like they wouldn't tell me on the phone. They couldn't explain it to me. But it's a national holiday because of the U.S. So while I was busy trying to get a lot of work done with them, you know, they were like, "Well, I'm at home," I'm out with my kids at the park. Like, oh man. So they've got Thursday to really get a jump on things, and then Friday, I'm sure there's going to be a little celebration at Ducati courses. The way whenever they win a race, they have a little Friday celebration with champagne. And then I think, and I'm not sure what Monday's doing, but Tuesday at dawn, we're leaving for China. So at least I think it's Tuesday. Maybe we're leaving on Monday. I don't know. Because of the time difference. I'll have to dig that up and find out.
Okay, today is Festa della Resistance, Liberation Day.
What's that?
It's the Liberation Day. That's what they're celebrating today. Festa della Resistanza.
I know that
whatever. marks the liberation of Italy from the by the Allies from German occupation in 1945.
I know that it's pretty tough to go to have testing after a race. Everybody looked a little run down, but we put in some really good lap times, and everybody's lap times improved because there was just that much rubber on the track. One thing I noticed over the weekend is that the track was dirty quite often. You know, tires would come in looking like they'd run through the gravel a little bit when they'd just been on the racetrack. So it was difficult to call on Friday and Saturday because the track was not so good. And then in the race, you saw all the black on the racetrack. Everybody was leaving rubber on the track. So I think that's why Sunday was particular, or Monday's after test was faster for everybody. So I'm not sure how much value that data will have. Of course, it's good data, but because all information is good.
I mean, they were significantly faster. Weren't they like half a second faster in general all the times? I saw a lot of 153s.
Yeah, a lot of 153s.
Which is pretty wild.
Smoking. And my boys got good starts this race. Yay! I'm so proud of our riders and our team for hanging in there. And
what a turnaround for you guys from Jerez, my God. It's like, because the last time I talked to you, you were like so down, and now you're like super elated. It's a total roller coaster.
Yeah, you know, I'm wiped out. I'm super tired. It's only 8:30, and I should just be crashed out because today was the first beautiful day I can remember in Barcelona in a long time. So I took the bike out, and I overdid it because I've been off the bike for a month, and I'm just exhausted from the tests and everything else that went down over the last week, and I've got to get a lot of work done. There's not enough time before China. And I want to put something on the website about the race, and I'll probably get to that late at night one of these nights. I'm stoked. It's a lot easier when you're up at the sharp end of the stick than when you're there, just there.
I remember you guys during preseason when we talked with you and we talked with Andrea, and you guys were like, you know, very cautious about being enthusiastic for the good results you had during the tests, and now I think it's finally time to, you know, really start, like, to enjoy this one, and then...
Yeah, I'm enjoying this one, but I'm still cautious because, that's the thing. I mean, we celebrated for 20 minutes after the race, and then we started tearing down the bikes and getting ready for the next test. And, you know, and all of the guys up and down the track were like that, and it's neat. Because the longer you're there, the more you can start to time the different teams in your head. And like on a Friday or a Saturday after the second practice, you know, it finishes up at 3, and by around 5, you know, or a couple hours later, you start hearing bikes firing up again. It's because people have changed engines, and now they're firing them up and making sure everything's working right. There's no leaks and you know, nothing screwy with them. And you hear when this factory fires their bikes up and when that factory fires their bikes up, and you kind of get this weird little timing. You're like, oh, yeah, I know who it is. I know what time it is. You know, we're 20 minutes behind, you know. But it was just fantastic. We had a beautiful dinner at the hotel that night, and, you know, everybody was tired. Hoff was tired from fighting his injuries through the race, and Barros was sick, so he just called it a night after dinner. And, you know, it was a quiet night because we knew we had to work the next day, and the riders were like, yeah, great result. For Hoffman, this is his best result with a Ducati, his second best result since he's been in MotoGP. And despite all the confidence and the high from the race, he said, no, I've got to be on it tomorrow because it's a test. And it's not like I'm just running around, you know. There's actual danger involved riding motorcycles.
Yeah, and the test especially, right? Because you don't have you don't have like those you don't have the fuel limits, so you probably run the engines a little bit hotter.
I don't know what kind of data you can get if you do that kind of stuff, but I will say I was extremely disappointed with the Turkish track workers.
Oh, really?
There weren't very many. They didn't make the right decisions when things happened on track during one of the free practices. you saw Nakano fall off, and his bike sat in the middle of the track. And one guy ran out, and Nakano was walking around, and he pulled him off the track because he ran off the track surface. And then he stood there with him, and everybody around that area red flagged the session with 5 minutes to go. So everybody comes into the pit. They left the bike there. Then finally, after everybody was off the racetrack, they went out and they picked the bike up and pulled it off the track. And it was the kind of thing where such a slow little thing, you should have just picked the bike up and pushed it off the track immediately after waving the yellow flag and let everybody do their thing. And, you know, both my riders had to get off their bike at some point during the free practices. And, you know, we're waiting around for them to bring us the bikes back from wherever on the track. And it just took forever. You know, 20 minutes plus, Barrels got off his bike and actually ran back to the garage on foot after, you know, we looked around forever. We didn't know, is he in the mobile clinic, Clinica Mobile, because of an injury? Did he crash? We had no data on it. We ran back and forth to the clinic area, which was, you know, all the way at the other end of the paddock. We're like, where is he? I don't know. Do you know where he is? Does anybody know where he is? What the hell's going on, you know?
What did happen?
Time is critical. Electrical.
Oh, okay.
That's going to be my excuse for everything.
Okay, right on.
It was an electrical. No, I don't remember. I know that he ran back to the garage, and it was like, Jesus. Actually seeing a guy in full leathers running back across... pathetic. It was really, really not so cool, those guys. But, you know, each track is different. We'll see how good the Chinese are. Other tracks are fantastic. They seem to have an abundance of track people that know exactly what to do, and as soon as an incident happens, boom, the corner workers are on it. You know, and other tracks, just they're, you know, they look around like, well, I don't know. What is that? Oh, I don't even know what kind of bike that is. Why are we even here? You know, I get weird feelings like that. I just go, man.
Well, it's a great
why
track.
Are you even there? Oh yeah, the track itself is fantastic. It was nice of Bernie Ecclestone to buy it, and then, you know, all the tests that were supposed to happen on Monday and Tuesday, we were told over the weekend. Oh, by the way, it's going to be $5,000 per rider to test. So that was an additional expense that nobody planned on.
Well, they're quoting financial difficulties as to why they might not be coming back there. So,
I guess yeah, it was nice to get that last minute little thank you. And I know some people were supposed to test for 2 days afterwards, but they packed it in after one day and just said to hell with it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if we'll go back there. It is a magnificent racetrack that rewards balls out riding. So I would like to go back there for that reason. On the racing side of things.
I mean, every class had a great race.
Yeah, and on the personal side of things, this is Istanbul. I mean, it's an amazing city that's just steeped in history. As you cross the bridge over the Bosphorus, there's a sign that says, Welcome to Asia. I mean,
that's so cool.
It is such a trip, and the people are so different, you know, the attitudes and kind of how they grew up. You know, there's not a lot of money there. And the people are really hard on the inside. You can tell there's not a lot of money because so many of the buildings in that city are not painted. They're just bare concrete. And you can tell by the level of the vehicles and how people dress. And the strange things was so many things were expensive. The Turkish milya lira, or I call it the Turkalirka, whatever the money was, it did not seem to go very far. It was strange. It was really bizarre how expensive some things were. I don't know if they're considered luxuries or what, but I bought some Turkish Colgate toothpaste, and it was expensive. Yeah,
it's that famous Turkish Colgate.
Yeah, I don't know what flavor it is. But it's definitely different than other Colgate. I have some Crest from Qatar that's really good, lemon flavored. Yeah, citrusy.
That's an interesting outlook on the world, is collecting the the toothpaste.
Well, geez, it's not like there's enough time to get anything done in the real world anyway. This phone call is a huge break for me from doing what I got to do. which is cool. You know, what I mentioned earlier in one of the podcasts that when I got to disconnect, I really need to disconnect completely. Because you put so much of yourself into it that you kind of lose touch with reality. And, you know, what for me, it's I lose touch with what's going on back home and what's going on in California. Because once it's game time and I get on a plane to go somewhere, I focus almost exclusively on the racing and a little bit of soaking in that city or that culture and trying to see things. And, you know, it's tough. I give the Australian guys a lot of credit. I don't know if it's their laid-back attitude they grow up with or what, but they seem to handle it just fine. Burgess told me that even with the extra race, 18 races, he goes, you know, it's still pretty easy. I'm still sitting at home in my house more than 6 months of the year if you add it up day by day or something like that. And I was just like, what a trip. The guy has to fly extra long everywhere we go because he's coming from that part of the world to Europe.
That's true.
But he's still so laid back. Like, yeah, I get to sit at home a lot, you know, hang out with his kids. He did confirm to me that the black eye he had last year was from the fence post that he was trying to move. I don't know. He's a really, really cool guy. I wish he was in the limelight more because he's so matter of fact and frank on his views and his ideas that it's really, really nice to see at this level. It's kind of typical, actually, of the Australians from what stories I've gathered, people telling me things, how a certain rider was. When you look at Casey, because I'm so close and I'm in there talking to those guys and, you know, see him every day. And there's no real nitpicking the way you get with some other riders that overanalyze everything. And they're like, no, I want a one click here. And I want a spring from, you know, whatever, 8.3 to 8.4 and one click there and this and that and back and forth and every which way. And we're going to try every single possible combination of settings and this and that, ride heights, triple clamps, offsets, forward, backwards, change the angle, change the rake and trail. Just you can just run yourself in circles. You know, and if you've only got a couple hours to get it done, it seems like the Aussies do really well because they come in and they're like, this is good, this is crap. Or, it's working, I can ride it, no biggie. This is fine, I'll be fine with it. You know, they're so laid back on it that it's really, really refreshing to watch Casey the way he picks and chooses how, you know, what happens with his bike. Really, really refreshing. Kid's got a bright future. Maybe I shouldn't call him a kid. I mean, he's married already. I haven't even done that.
He's a kid. He's a married kid.
I'm going to come back to what I was thinking about Elias' style.
Oh,
yeah. The guy has such an extreme, you know, ass-off-the-bike style. A real low, really low. He gets his whole body and center of gravity low off the side of the bike. That I wondered, you know, whenever I've tried to ride anything like that, as soon as the rear tire starts to move around to the front tire, like it's really difficult to get the feeling of what's happening with the bike, much less, you know, I would expect to see more high sides out of him because of that style, because there's not a lot of weight over the back wheel. It's just kind of sliding and spinning, and then you'd think, oh, it'll catch and flip him over. But I wonder if him being so off to the side and so low, you know, is preventing that to a small degree. Like, if he really did step out and catch, it would throw him up because nothing stops a high side. But I wonder if, with his riding style, whether or not he's able to modulate that a little bit, because you don't see him flying down the track too much in the gravel.
When he goes up the track, it's usually just he just runs off. He doesn't doesn't fly off. I've never actually seen him have a bad crash.
I think the reason why I started thinking about his style a little bit more is I read the Italian press release with Rossi talking about him being dangerous and that he should be sanctioned and this and that. And in my mind, a dangerous rider is unpredictable because he's going to crash and take someone out. And I don't see Elias doing that. So that's why I started thinking about it. Plus, he's a great kid. And on a supermoto, I think he could take anybody in the GP paddock. I'm trying to source some video of that at the moment. But apparently, it's incredible. what he can do with a supermoto bike. So perhaps that's where he's polished and honed his sliding ability.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, he's the only one who's really doing it at this point. You know, like Nicky Haynes
trying it.
Yeah,
he's found a way to exploit the bike.
Yeah.
You know, what it's not designed to do, he's found a way to go faster doing what he wants to do. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, it's generally not going to be as consistent because he's going against the grain with the way the factory develops things. But, you know, in the meantime, it's spectacular. And personally, you know, he's such a good kid that I enjoy watching him up there. You know, I told him that he needed to change his bike because he looked too much like Rossi, which you told me the last time.
Yeah. He changed the color of the numbers on it, actually.
Yeah, he changed the color of the numbers and the helmet. So, you know, obviously he listened to what you said.
Yes, yes. I'm glad I've got that kind of pull.
Yeah. Oh, on another point, somebody that I emailed with had made a song for the Superbike Planet, the Isle of Man song. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with that MP3. And through the grapevine, he heard that Chuck Axlin was listening to it, but he didn't believe him. So I asked Chuck this past weekend, hey, do you have that song from Superbike? And he's like, yeah, the Isle of Man one. That's really good. I gave it to Daniel Day-Lewis. And I'm just thinking, what is this bizarre world I've got myself in where I'm asking about an MP3 to somebody, and they're telling me about Daniel Day-Lewis? Like, what? What is happening, Jules?
That's
it's really bizarre.
That's
it's really bizarre. Okay, everybody in MotoGPOD land, hope you had a good drive or sitting at your house or whatever it is you're doing, but stay tuned to the races because it's they're cracking this year.
It's only going to get better.
Bunch of races. Yeah, and they're only going to get better because everybody is taking steps forward, and I hope we can get better too. So thanks for all the support. I want to thank everybody for emailing me. And thanks for understanding. I can't get back to people, you know, sometimes for 3 days, a week, whatever. But it meant a lot to, you know, to crack open my email and see everything because I didn't have a good internet connection. We didn't have, we weren't connected at the racetrack like we are at some other circuits, and the hotel didn't have any bandwidth in the lobby. It was a 5-star hotel, which in actuality was like a 2.2 or something. But it was 5-star for there. Outrageously overpriced that had Wi-Fi available in the lobby. But if more than 5 computers were logged on, everyone would end up with the same IP address and you couldn't do anything. You'd sit there for 3 hours trying to connect, as I did a couple nights, and nothing would happen. So, you know, I didn't really get to any emails until earlier this afternoon after I'd gotten some work done. And, wow, just really nice. Of everybody to write and you know keep supporting the Black Sheep Squadron. We have to wear red on the race weekend, but Wednesday and Thursday when we're building everything and setting it up, we're dressed in black, as it should be. And Monday for the test, we're dressed in black. And that's the way it should be. You know that's who we are, and we're just going to keep doing the good fight like we always do. So hopefully, watch for Barrels and Hoffman to really shake things up.
Excellent, excellent. Good luck, man. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Jules.
Great stuff, Liam, and good luck in Shanghai. Liam has posted some incredible blog entries at his blog at MotoLiam.com lately. I've posted links to them in the show notes, so be sure to check them out. They are not to be missed. Okay, on to some news. The big news recently was Ilmore. Withdrew from MotoGP prior to the Jerez round, and this week confirmed rumors that they would not be returning, at least not in the same capacity. Team principal Mario Ilien discussed the possibility of becoming a GP motor provider, so hopefully they will not be completely removed from the series. Roberto Locatelli had a really nasty crash during 250 practice at Jerez. Because he doesn't remember anything, we'll probably never know why he went off the track at high speed, crashing into a tire wall. But the crash was massive, and Locatelli suffered major facial and other injuries. His state was so critical that he had to be placed in an induced coma, brought slowly out after a few days, and it was days later that doctors could finally say that he had suffered no permanent brain damage. As soon as he was conscious, Roberto announced his plans to be fit and ready for the Le Mans round at the end of May. Now that is what I call spirit. Whoa. Here's wishing you all the best in your recovery, Roberto. Loris Caparossi became a dad following the Jerez round, and following his third place finish at Istanbul, said that his season starts here. We'll see. I have a feeling that this season will often consist of being in wonder about Casey Stoner, like the rest of us. But congratulations on his son, to him and his wife. On a sad note, I'd like to send my condolences to the friends and family of Matt Lab, who was killed during a track day at a local racetrack in California recently. I've never met Matt, but the outpouring of shock and emotion on the BARF Bay Area Writers Forum boards says volume about his character. He's obviously missed, and our thoughts are with those who knew and loved him. And this wraps up show number 76. Thank you for listening, and also thank you for your patience. The show will eventually get back to a more regular schedule, but for now, please stay patient, and when the show goes up, keep listening. Thank you to Liam Schubert, David Emmett, Bob Hayes, Heidi Kender, Jim Race, Jules Schmerny, and many others. Take care and see you next time. Ciao.